This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Maybe you've spent more time at home with your dog in recent months and thought, what are they thinking? Or, so this is what they do all day. A couple of months ago, we spoke with Ellen Furlong on The 21st. She's an associate professor of psychology at Illinois Wesleyan University and has set out to answer these questions in her research. She leads Illinois Wesleyan's Dog Scientists team in Bloomington, and she recently collaborated with Audible on an audiobook called Decoding Dogs Inside the Canine Mind. Here now is that conversation. Ellen, welcome to The 21st.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
So Ellen, your background is in psychology, and yet you are studying animals. Are you learning about human psychology through dogs, or do I maybe just have a very narrow view of what psychology is?
Great question. Psychology actually encompasses a whole lot of different things. I'm going to get this number wrong, but there are something like 57 different divisions of the American Psychological Association that look at psychology from very different angles. So a lot of psychologists study animals, but many psychologists study animals as sort of models for how we can learn more about, say how the brain works or how human psychology works. I'm really interested in studying animals because of what it can tell us about how evolution might be able to shape the ways that we think and the way that we behave. There are lots of reasons to study animals, but my particular interest is really in sort of the evolution of cognition, the evolution of decision-making in particular, and how different kinds of pressures in our environment might have shaped our minds.
So you lead the Illinois Wesleyan University Dog Scientists team. What sorts of studies were you doing there, at least in the before times, pre-COVID?
Yes, pre-COVID, we were doing lots of things. We do a lot of work looking at social reasoning in dogs. Dogs are really good at thinking about humans as social partners and reading our social cues that we give them. And so we're interested in sort of digging into that a little bit more deeply. We also study problem solving and decision making in dogs. So one of our recent studies was looking at self-control. And looking for breed differences in self-control, which was pretty fun. We just had a paper out last month looking at how training differences might affect social evaluation. So deciding whether somebody is a good guy or a bad guy seems to be a little bit dependent, at least on training. So we do lots of different kinds of studies with our dogs in the lab. All of the dogs that participate in our work are pet dogs from the local community, and they and their owners come in and we give the dogs these problems to solve. The owners can watch their dogs as they navigate these challenges that we put in front of them, and everybody has a good time. The dogs think they're there to get pets and treats, and we videotape it and learn more about their behavior after they're done playing.
Okay, now you've teased this research. So what breed has more self-control? What and which has the least?
So this is wacky. When we did this study, we expected to find that herding dogs and hunting dogs would be really good at self-control because herding dogs essentially hunt but don't kill the animals that they're hunting. And hunting dogs do all kinds of things, but for example, they might go retrieve something but not eat it. That the hunter has shot a bird, for example. So we thought they might be really good at self-control, but that terriers, whose job is to go underground and go like murder a rat, would have less self-control because they need less self-control to do their job. But actually we found completely upside down effects. So we found that the terriers were actually really good at self-control. The herding dogs were terrible at it, and our hunting dogs were sort of somewhere in the middle. So we're still trying to make sense of that, of those breed differences right now. And we wish we could collect more data, but yeah. We're, not at the moment because of COVID.
We should talk more about this. I'm picturing a marshmallow test for dogs, but we need to take a quick break here. We're speaking dog psychology with Ellen Furlong, an associate professor of psychology at Illinois Wesleyan University. This is The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're re-airing a conversation we had in September with Ellen Furlong, an associate professor of psychology at Illinois Wesleyan University in Bloomington, where she heads the Dog Scientists team. She also recently collaborated with the company Audible on an audiobook called Decoding Dogs: Inside the Canine Mind. She joined us to talk about her work and to answer your questions about just what is going on in the mind of your dog. As a reminder, this conversation was taped a few months ago, so there's no call-in number today, but we always love to hear what you thought about what we talked about. The email address is talk@21stshow.org or leave a voicemail at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. On with the conversation. Ellen, Audible, the audiobook company, approached you about doing this book I just mentioned, Decoding Dogs, as part of the Great Courses series. What do you hope people will understand after listening to the audiobook?
Yeah, I think our dogs are really complicated and really fascinating. And so I think one thing that I really hope people understand is just how complex they are and how different their needs are from ours. So a lot of times we look at our dogs and see ourselves reflected back, and we think that they need the same kinds of things to be happy that we need. But really, they live in a very different kind of a world than we do. They live in a world that's very much about smell. And so, for example, one thing that you can do to make your dog happy that might seem, you know, out of the ordinary is to let them smell things a lot. A lot of times when we take our dogs for walks, we encourage them to keep moving along. We think that what they need on a walk is exercise. And while that's true, they also need that mental stimulation that they get from stopping and sniffing things. It's essentially their morning news when they get out there and they smell what's happened overnight in their neighborhood. And so one thing I think that we can, one sort of practical application that we can get from understanding more about our dogs is to give them sniffy walks where they stop and they sniff everything that they want to, and they really decide when to move on, when they're satisfied and when they're ready to move on. And the more we understand about our dogs, the more cases like that we will be able to find, the more things that we'll be able to do to make them happier and healthier.
You begin your audiobook by sort of laying out how to think about dog intelligence and this idea that human intelligence is very different from canine intelligence. Can you talk about what you mean by that?
Yeah. So dogs and humans have very different histories. Dogs evolved from wolves through a long process of domestication. The kinds of things that they need to be able to do.
And when you say long, you mean tens, if not hundreds of thousands of years, right?
Yeah, we don't actually know. Okay. It's really interesting. The whole history of domestication is kind of a bit of an argument at the moment. Some people argue that dogs became dogs about 30,000 years ago, 30 to 40,000 years ago. Others say that dogs became dogs about 15,000 years ago. So we don't know exactly how long it took for dogs to become dogs. The argument really comes down to sort of disagreements about archaeological records and also sort of reasons why dogs might have evolved. So there's still lots of stuff up in the air about dog science in general, but domestication is one of those places where we are still learning. And so the kind of environment that dogs domesticated in is kind of different. So in many ways, humans are the environment for dogs. So dogs really evolved to survive and thrive in an environment that included humans. So this means that they had to change from their sort of wolf-like behavior into a behavior that was more compatible living around humans. The kinds of skills that you need to navigate a human environment if you're wolf-like are very different than the kinds of skills you need to navigate a human environment if you're human-like. So humans, for example, are going to talk to each other, but dogs don't have the vocal apparatus to do that. So they need to be smart in some other ways in order to communicate with humans.
On that note of how dogs communicate with humans, we put a question out to our texting group. How has your relationship with your dog changed since the pandemic? What's something you've always wondered about how dogs see the world? And we got a response from Julie in Mapleton, which is just outside of Peoria. Julie said, I've been fortunate to foster dogs, a great way to spend the pandemic. Sometimes it seems that foster dogs have a special sense and try to make it clear who they want for their forever family. In those cases, my job is to try to recognize that. Is it possible that some of them just know and try to communicate it, or am I reading too much into that? And then Julie also asks, do rescued dogs realize they've been rescued? Some people contend that they do and are grateful. So, Ellen, how would you respond to Julie? Do dogs just know when they've found their forever home or the right owner for them?
That's a great question. So here's where I'm going to point out that dog science is really young. We are a very young field. People have only really been doing research studying dogs for the sake of learning more about dogs for about the last 20 years. Dogs were involved in research before that, but they were just subjects, right? It wasn't about dogs. And so we have so many questions still to answer. And those two questions that Julie... brought up are great questions that I just don't think we have answers to right now. In some ways, it's hard to do research to find out the answers to some of those questions. How do you measure gratitude, for example? How do you measure, how would you operationally define or measure when a dog is telling you that this person is their person? We do sometimes get research ideas from sort of our day-to-day kinds of experiences. So for example, I know that my dog definitely chose me. she was living out in the woods near my parents' cabin and was like, you are my person and I'm going home with you. You know, if she were given an option of people to choose and I wasn't, you know, one of the only three people in the woods, would she have still chosen me? I don't know. And so it's really, could be a really interesting research question. As for the question about gratitude, that's another one that I think would be a really great research question. I'd have to think really hard about how we would study that. I do know one researcher, Alexandra Horowitz New York, has done some research on a related kind of emotion, which is shame. So a lot of times people think that their dogs feel shame when they, say, have an accident in the house or something. But really what the dog is, what research has shown is what the dog is doing is actually showing you signs of submission. They recognize that you're mad about something and they're trying to placate you. And so sometimes we do read into dogs more emotions than maybe they are showing, but other times the emotions that they're showing us seem to be really founded in something real. So for example, another researcher, Greg Burns, has done some really interesting work with dogs in fMRI scanners. And in this work, he has shown that the same part of the dog's brains light up when they smell their owner as the parts of their brain that light up, say, when they're having a delicious treat. So it seems like they really do like us, you know, and that's another emotion that we read in our dogs. So sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong. And until we do research, we really don't know.
I want to, and Alexandra Horowitz, who you mentioned, has a great primer, I think, on this topic, Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. But now we are talking to Ellen Furlong, who is the author of the audiobook Decoding Dogs, Inside the Canine Mind, which is from Audible. It's an audiobook. It's part of the Great Courses series. I want to ask you about, I don't know if you're familiar with this celebrity dog named Bunny. It's sort of one of these TikTok stars. Its owner set up a way for the dog to apparently communicate by pushing these big buttons arrayed in a grid on the floor, and the buttons say things like outside and I love you. Do you think Bunny is actually able to communicate?
So I think there's a really important distinction to be made between communication and language. And it's for sure, I have no doubt that dogs communicate. I don't think anybody would argue that dogs communicate. They wag their tail at us, they bark at us, they communicate with each other.
They have a very rich communication. And so I think what Bunny is doing here maybe can fall under that, where she's using these buttons as, you know, she's associated the button with a particular outcome. So she's associated hitting the walk button with going for a walk. I have no doubt that that's something that dogs are capable of doing.
This is operant conditioning, right?
Exactly, exactly. But I don't think that what Bunny is doing is language. So language is really much more rich. It involves grammar and structure and the ability to generate new ideas. And I haven't seen any evidence that Bunny is doing anything like that. She'll push, you know, a button to get her what she wants, but she's not combining those buttons in new ways to mean new things.
Yeah, interesting. Because the owner makes a big deal, or the trainer, however you want to say it, the human, the dog's human, depending on how you want to phrase that, is, you know, talks to the dog and uses phrases and attempts to get the dog to respond. But I suppose, yeah, that could be a matter of conditioning as well. I also want, we had another question by text from Justin in Rockford, who said, I'm like a cat lady, but with dogs. My house is a league of canine nations, German Shepherd, Golden Retriever, Newfoundland. And one of Justin's questions was, does it send a confusing message of equality if your dog sleeps with you in bed?
Oh, interesting question. A message of equality if say one of your dogs sleeps with you, but not the others?
I'll let you take that where you will. It's a question by text message. There are certain limitations to the format.
Exactly. Yeah. my guess is that,
or maybe human dog equality or something like that.
Oh,
right?
Okay. Human dog.
You get into
equality.
I'm just guessing here, but there's the, you know, the popular television show about the dog trainer who says you're the pack leader, right? I mean,
yeah,
that kind of thing.
So that popular television show is based on some myths about dogs and about wolves. The idea there is that humans need to be the alpha of the pack. They need to be the unquestioning leader, and that dogs need to step into line and follow the leader. But that's based on some work that was done with wolves in captivity, in which it looked a lot like wolves had that kind of pack structure with this alpha in charge who sort of puts everybody in their place and tells them how to behave. But when you actually look at wolves in the wild, they're much more egalitarian. They're much more of a family unit. What seems to happen is in captivity, they're under some stress because when they hit adulthood, they want to go out on their own and form their own wolf family, but they're not able to because they're trapped there. And that seems to create tension. It actually, the best sort of ways to think about your relationship with your dog is actually the old phrase, your dog is your best friend. And if you think about your dog as a friend in your sort of social network, then that's a good way to explain any, say, differences in the way that you and we've got two dogs, and one of the dogs and I are very, very close, and the other one and I are good buddies, but it's not the same kind of relationship, right? So that kind of friendship that you have with different people, where I might have a really close friendship with one person, and my husband has a bit closer relationship with another person, we have the same kind of dynamic with our dogs. If you think about it that way, then the way that you treat your dogs is going to be a little more gentle than the approach of, you know, you have to be in charge. And when you're a little more gentle, it's a better outcome usually. So the research suggests that the best way of training dogs and getting them to learn the rules of the household is through positive reinforcement. So celebrating what they're doing well rather than punishment.
Yeah. And I guess, just lesson from life, trying to be the pack leader of your group of human friends, maybe not the best way to make more friends.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm afraid we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. Ellen Furlong is a professor of psychology at Illinois Wesleyan University, leads the dog scientists team there in Bloomington, and is the author of Decoding Dogs, Inside the Canine Mind. You can find it at Audible. Ellen, thanks so much for speaking with us about your work today on the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. That is all the time we have for today. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Eunice Alpasan's our engagement producer, and our interns are Zainab Qureshi, Brielle Skullark, and Chantel Vaca. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll talk to you tomorrow.